Hello, Star Trek fans, and welcome to the Rebinge Deep Space Nine podcast. My name is Kim.
And my name is James.
And we are watching Star Trek Deep Space Nine from the beginning, one episode at a time. Welcome back to the podcast. Today we are watching Season 1, Episode 14, entitled Progress. This episode aired May 9th, 1993. Before we get started on this episode, is there anything from the previous podcast that we need to talk about?
No, it was perfect.
I'm going to have to take your word for it because I have not listened to it yet. Have you listened to it?
Yeah, maybe.
Chances are great. It's perfect.
Yeah.
Like always. I'm still mired in the previous one and the nonstop editing. Okay, let's get started.
Okay.
We open in Quarks with Nog and Jake playing cards, like normal old-fashioned cards.
Yeah.
Coming down from level two, Quark is complaining to Rom that he's stuck with 5,000 wrappages of Cardassian yamek sauce. Only Cardassians can stomach that swill. Quark says he's going to take half of Rom's paycheck every week for the next 6 years just to cover the cost.
That must be expensive yamek sauce.
Well, it's 5,000 of them, so yeah. Meanwhile, Nog is distracted, listening to his father getting yelled at. But he's not upset. Instead, he seems excited by all of this yamek sauce. Jake keeps yelling at him to pay attention to the game, and he throws his cards down, saying the game is over. Nog says he's getting that tingling in his lobes.
He should see a doctor, because that could be an infection of the tympanic membrane. Very dangerous for Ferengi.
That's right. I was going to say that killed the Negus, but it didn't really, because it was fake, and the Negus was alive, but it could have.
Yes. There was a risk of it.
So Nog says when a lobe tingles, it means only one thing. Is it gross? I'm sure it's something gross.
You have a very negative view of the Ferengi.
Yes. But he says it means opportunity. And Jake would rather play cards than worry about an opportunity to pick up 4 or 5 bars of latinum.
Well, money has no meaning in the Federation.
Yeah, I guess that's why Jake is like, I don't care.
Right.
But Nog is all excited about this and he says, come on. And he takes off and Jake runs off after him. And again, sweet, quiet Jake running after a manic Nog. This is a theme with these two.
Nog dragging him into some kind of trouble.
You know it is. Then we see the station from the outside, and Sisko is recording a station log. Stardate 46844.3. Anyone keeping track of these stardates? Not me. So I hope it's the right number and means something to someone.
I just make up numbers.
Oh my god. We go into ops as Sisko is saying that with the help of the Federation, Bajor is about to commence its first large-scale energy transfer by tapping into its fifth moon, called Jurado.
Isn't that a character from Picard?
Jurado?
Jurati?
Oh, Dr. Jurati. That's right. That is her name. It's not spelled the same. It totally threw me. So as Sisko is walking through ops, there is an unfamiliar Bajoran following him. You'd think that the Bajorans would be a little testy with him considering he lost their Kai a couple of episodes ago, but they seem fine. The guy following him has the dullest outfit on. I don't even know what color it was. It was like colorless. It had no style. It was very unusual for this show to have just no style at all in somebody's costume.
I think that might have been a deliberate choice because the guy is just a Bajoran bureaucrat, so...
It was the color of bureaucracy.
Yeah, they were sort of making a hint of he's kind of a nameless, faceless man in a boring suit.
Oh, such a good point. Dax and Rolled Up Sleeve Miles are saying that everything is fine. The visitor asks about a red blinking light. And I was like, dude, if you're going to get concerned about every red blinking light on this station, this place is not for you. Because everything is always broken.
Yeah, I'm thinking Miles missed a really good chance to totally prank him here. I mean, he could have gone, what red light? Oh, that red light!
No, they've all got their game faces on.
Yeah.
Miles reassures him that everything is fine.
Plus, Sisko probably would have got annoyed.
Sisko would have definitely gotten annoyed. Kira finally says who this guy is. It's somebody named Minister Toran. Kira says, these people are professionals. He apologizes for his bureaucratic nitpicking, but Bajor is counting on the energy from the moon to heat a few 100,000 homes this winter. Kira says, well, with that in mind, we're due to make our next inspection, and off she goes. Now Dax and Kira are in a shuttle. Dax is telling a story about Morn inviting her to dinner while she was at Quark's. Why does she even go in there? Every time she goes in there, somebody is hitting on her. Usually it's Quark, but now it's Morn. Some sciencey stuff is said here as they're scanning the moon. And Kira says, Morn, are you serious? Which I think is what I said out loud, exactly the same thing before she said it.
Great expression from Kira there. I mean, the look on her face is like... What?
Dax told him that she's busy, but she says those 7 or 8 little wiry hairs that come out of his forehead make him look cute. I think Kira might vomit at this with the look on her face.
Yes.
She must think, am I the only sane person on the station?
I'm surrounded by crazy people.
I don't get this at all. It's, again, just trying to make it okay that guys are endlessly creeping on her because she's okay with it. Yeah, right. This is just not right.
Well, we don't know what Morn's gender is, so it's never discussed.
I'm relatively confident they've said he about him in the past.
Oh, okay.
And also, it's just like an endless theme in every single episode. That's the part that's more annoying to me. It's like, just let it go.
Right. We get it. She's cute.
We get it. Exactly. Just then, Dax picks up a humanoid presence, saying it's in 15 Delta. And she says maybe it's one of the project thermologists.
Oh, are they messaging her saying, are you available for a date?
Oh my God. Maybe. Is that a real thing? A thermologist? The online dictionary says a thermologist is one that studies thermology. Oh, thanks. Super helpful.
Oh,
what I do know
yes.
for sure is that Apple identifies all of those words as misspelled. It doesn't think any of them are real. Anyway, Kira is annoyed because all the inhabitants were supposed to be evacuated by now. So what is this about? She says she'll beam down and look around. And she says she won't be long as Dax transports her away.
Yeah.
And Kira beams into a lovely little garden and is immediately threatened with pitchforks by two unhappy looking villagers. Man, this show loves an angry mob. Well, in this case, it's only a mob of two, but still. Now they have actual pitchforks.
But they were very grumpy looking. I'll give them that. They looked quite serious and grumpy.
Yes, and they didn't say anything. They just pointed pitchforks at her. And then we cue the theme song.
Opening credits.
After the credits, a third person appears saying that the pitchfork villagers don't like uniforms. And Kira says calmly, neither do I, but it comes with the job. So the old guy who's standing in the doorway of his cottage asks what that job is. And when Kira asks if they're going to talk or attack, the old dude waves off the pitchfork guys. Brian Keith, again, a guest star with quite a long IMDb reputation.
166 acting credits.
It's like we don't take anyone on this show unless they've got at least 150 things in IMDb. This is serious business.
Well, I actually remember him from a show in the, I think it was early 80s, called Hardcastle and McCormick.
Oh my gosh, I forgot all about that.
Yeah, I remember watching that as a kid in the UK. I also noticed he would have been like 70 when he appeared in the show. So he really had quite a long career.
I know him from The Parent Trap, the original one, I believe. And then also he was in a show that aired in reruns when I was a kid.
Yeah.
It was called Family Affair. So I know him as this sort of soft father-like figure. So he kind of fits here as this character. I'm really impressed with the quality of the guest actors so far. It's been great.
Oh, yeah.
So when Kira walks over to the old guy, he says, you're halfway pretty. What the hell does that mean? He said he's had his fill of uniformed bullies, and Kira says she's no Cardassian, and then tells him the area was evacuated and he's supposed to be out of there by now. He says, all I know is this farm girl. It's like, oh, man. Kira asks him not to call her girl, thank you very much. Then she tries to talk farms with him to get on his good side, and eventually he says, pretty eyes like yours deserve a meal, and he invites her in.
She's being kind of forcefully polite, is the way I would describe it.
She is, yeah. She says, we don't have time, you need to get out of here now, and Brian Keith says, we'll talk about it over supper. And then he says that he's going to make her something with root vegetables that take 3 hours to cook. It's like, great.
He's in no hurry.
Then we go back to DS9, and Jake and Nog are running on the second level of Quarks, looking down on someone. Jake is wearing the brightest aquamarine outfit I think I've seen, and it has bright green and yellow on top.
Oh, he is very colorful, yes.
He is, and Nog is in his usual orange and mustard colored outfit. They see whoever it is that they're after, and they go running down the stairs. An alien with a very large rubber head and a faux leather outfit is getting up from a table and leaving Quarks. Nog runs up to him asking if he's the captain of the Lysepian cargo ship, and he says he is.
That's a really good costume.
It's pretty serious, yeah.
I was very impressed with the way they'd made up the head. Compared to some of the costumes we've seen on the show to this point, this one looked really good.
Yeah, it did. Nog asks him if he does a lot of trading with Cardassians, and the dude says he does because Cardassians pay their bills. Then they tell the guy about the yamak sauce that they have to sell. He's interested, but he doesn't have any latinum. He says he'll trade 100 gross of self-sealing stem bolts for the yamak sauce. He says a Bajoran ordered them and now he can't pay. And all of these words are made up words.
Yeah.
Yamak sauce, self-sealing stem bolts. These are all made up.
I did like how Nog was negotiating in this. He did seem to be fairly good at it.
I don't know. He has one number in mind
that
he's trying to get, and it doesn't even matter what he has or how he does it. He's just like, somehow I have to get this number of bars of latinum. And so he's never thinking very far ahead. He's always just thinking of that one number.
Yeah.
So I wasn't very impressed with his negotiating skills. He's like stuck on that thing. He should go and find out what is that really worth before he says, ooh, if only I could get 5 bars of latinum.
Well, I think that's what his complete focus is. But the fact that he's actually negotiating and trying to do this thing, I thought was a pointer to him being perhaps a better Ferengi in terms of business than his father.
But he is ready to walk away from the deal because he's only interested in latinum. Jake asks if he's sure. So, I mean, it kind of takes Jake to push him in the right direction. And then they decide to make the trade.
Yeah.
And Nog shakes the guy's hand and they agree to meet at 2100 hours in Cargo Bay 9.
That is true. Jake did make him think of the bigger picture.
Yes. Because then Nog wonders what they're going to do with all the stem bolts. And Jake asks the more important question, which is, how are we even going to get the Yamek sauce?
Jake just has to ruin it, doesn't he?
Jake is pretty pragmatic for a 14-year-old. Back down on the moon, we're at Brian Keith's house. I don't think we've said the guy's name yet. That's why in my notes, I just kept typing in Brian Keith. I didn't know what his name was.
That's not a very Bajoran name.
And we're making something with root vegetables. And he says again that it's going to take 3 hours to cook. Must be rutabagas. Ugh.
Is that where he bashes one of them on the counter and it's like thud, thud,
yes.
thud?
Yes. Yes. That's when I was sure it was a rutabaga.
Yeah.
Kira then calls Dax and says she's hanging out with a man who has a talent for delay. And Brian Keith looks confused about where the voices are coming from. That was kind of cute. As he looks up and around, like, where's that coming from? Kira tells Dax to leave her there and she'll have one of the unseen thermologists take her back to DS9.
Yeah.
Then Brian Keith gets Kira peeling vegetables. Kira then notices the other two housemates, the ones with the pitchforks from earlier. She notices that they don't talk much. And Brian Keith says the Cardassians took care of that. They escaped to the moon 18 years ago and he's been there for 40 years. They never explain what that means, how the Cardassians took care of them not being able to speak. Is it just out of fear or did they cut their tongues out or something? It was a weird thing to say.
I assume it was something awful that they did to them.
Okay. Then he tells Kira to get out the plates and utensils like a good girl, which seems to irritate her, but she gets the plates. Then he says, while looking at her from the back, you know, you look real good, even from this angle. Just throw the plate at him and leave him on the moon. Who the hell cares? God. He says she walks like a carnivorous rastapod. Then as she gets annoyed, he kind of smiles and she realizes that he's trying to annoy her, so she'll leave. He's clearly never met her.
He's totally trying to bait her, yes.
Yeah, he is. He asks her name and she says she's Major Kira in charge of the evacuation. But he asks for her given name and she says it's Nerisse. He says his name is Mullyback and he keeps cutting up the vegetables. She sits down and tells him that in 7 days, they're going to begin tapping the core of the moon. The project is going to benefit hundreds of thousands of people. Mullyback says he knows, and he made himself unconcerned with that 40 years ago when he escaped from a Cardassian labor camp from Bajor, which he calls your precious Bajor, I noted.
Yeah.
And she's really struck by that. She says, we're trying to create something now that you weren't allowed to have then. It can be your Bajor too. She says it'll be fine. And he says if he leaves his farm, he'll die. And he'd rather die here in his home.
This is interesting.
I also noticed that Kira needs a haircut. Her hair's getting long. Maybe she's been in lockdown.
There's a couple of ways I'm looking at this, and they're kind of contradictory. I mean, the first one is he's hiding up on this moon away from the rest of Bajoran society and is relatively unconcerned about them. He was in a Cardassian labor camp and escaped and has been hiding there. Part of me is, so he doesn't care about Bajor or anything that's happening to it and is completely selfish when he could have helped in the liberation of it, been like Kira and fought in the resistance, that kind of thing. Instead of he hid there. And now that something's happening that will benefit Bajor, he's kind of standing in the way of it. So he's
on purpose.
He's being extremely sort of self-centered in this.
Mm.
And at the same time, when humans say that, oh, well, we're going to move you somewhere else and it'll be really nice, you'll be fine, that it usually doesn't work out best for the people who are being displaced.
Right.
So I'm having an odd balance issue here between the two things.
Yeah, and part of me is just like, it's just a stubborn old guy who is set in his ways. And he's, you know, later when he starts telling her stories and these stories are really embellished and really long, This is just kind of a world that he's put himself in, and yeah. This is his comfort zone.
Right.
So, there, you know, it could be that, too. That's a third option. Just an old guy who's stuck, and he doesn't want any change.
Yeah.
He feels like he already fought one battle, and he doesn't want to fight anymore. Certainly not one that is forced upon him.
Yeah, yeah.
And he also, you know, oh God, there's so many interpretations, because he also might just feel abandoned by Bajor. And so he's like, screw that. They didn't do anything for me. I'm not doing anything for them.
But if he's been up there 40 years, I mean, he was there for basically the whole of the occupation.
Yeah.
You do see a great close-up here, though, of Kira in her uniform.
Yeah.
And, you know, with the little, the communicator badge. She looks kick-ass. That is a great uniform.
Okay. Back in Quark's, Nog approaches the bar to talk to his uncle Quark. Quark says that the previous night when a Dabble player dropped his drink, he saw Nog run and get him another drink without charging him.
Oh, dear.
Then he grabs Nog's ear painfully, reminding him that he'd best not pick up his father's habits. I thought his father was just, like, bamboozled by pretty girls. Isn't that what happened in the episode with the Negus?
I think that might have been an excuse. Because he gave the woman her currency pouch back.
Yes.
I think it might be a pointer to Rom just being kind of a decent fellow, certainly for
and
a Ferengi.
Quark telling him not to become a decent fellow.
Yes.
Yes, that makes sense. Yeah.
Be a Ferengi.
And Nog does swear that it'll never happen again. Then he has to muster up the courage to ask about helping get rid of the Yamek sauce. And Quark says, just do anything, get it out of his sight. And then as he's walking off, he feels bad and he tells Nog that he's a good boy.
I like the way Nog kind of manipulated Quark and did it, you know, sort of in a subtle way.
He didn't tell him what he was up to at all.
No, no.
Yeah.
And made it seem like he was doing something for his uncle. I thought that was very Ferengi. And the second thing is, again, you see Quark isn't quite the perfect Ferengi. He felt bad about admonishing Nog and basically said sorry to him.
I also wonder if they just decided maybe they needed to give him at least one redeeming trait.
Yes.
Which was he's nice to his nephew, because otherwise, ugh, so awful.
You're right. I mean, that is something you want to do in the writing of a show. You can't make an unlikable character completely unlikable if they're going to be a regular on the show. They have to have some redeeming features. And I think the goal for Quark is to be the lovable rogue.
Because right now he's just the rogue.
Exactly.
And it can't just be that he has nice tailored clothing. It has to be something more than that.
Yeah, he can't just have a nice suit.
Right.
Did you notice in this scene where the excited Nog waves at Jake, the woman standing next to him was wearing a extremely purple outfit?
I did notice the woman next to him, actually, because it looked like she was talking to him, but I didn't notice that she was wearing purple.
Yes.
Oh my gosh, I'll have to go back and look. How did I miss the purple? I was probably taking notes.
You've made me now look for the purple.
Dang, good job. Can't believe I missed that.
The way they're making Quark, he's not completely heartless.
But he also learned in that episode, The Negus, that he should keep his eye on his family members because Rom was going to send him out the airlock. So keep your enemies closer.
I would expect in Ferengi society, your worst enemies would probably be members of your family.
Yeah, for sure. We go back down to the moon, and Mollybeck is telling a story about stowing away on a Cardassian survey vessel. He overpowered the crew and stole what he needed. Kira is a little suspicious of this story, that he overpowered a crew of six on his own. Then he says he was the first person ever to settle on the moon, and he didn't have any kind of farm implements. He says every 26 hours, he tightened his belt to fool his body into thinking he was eating. And Kira is like, what? He says, let me tell the story and stop asking questions.
This is a classic tall tale, isn't
it? For sure. The two silent house partners keep giving each other knowing looks, which may or may not mean anything. I think maybe it was just cheaper that they didn't have any lines, but also they've maybe heard all of these ridiculous stories over 40 years.
Yeah, that's what I assume.
Mollybeck said he knew he needed to plant and harvest a crop. He tells a story about rolling around on the ground, which was weird, and then plowing the soil with his fingernails. And Kira is definitely realizing that his stories are embellished.
Yeah.
As one of the silent people clears the table, the other pours some wine, and Mollybeck asks Kira her story. Says she looks like a fighter. She says you had to be to survive on Bajor. Mollybeck calls the Cardassians mindless butchers, and Kira says we paid them back. She says they didn't stand a chance because they were so outmatched by the Cardassian weapons, but they won because they hung on like fanatics.
Yeah.
And Brian Keith smiles broadly to that line. He says, I've got to remember that. And then he steps outside and Kira follows. I thought that was like a dangerous lesson for her to teach him, that if you hang on like a fanatic, you'll win.
Oh, really? I saw this as a different way. I saw him as he was smart enough to figure out something like that about Kira. And basically, this story was a misdirection of, you thought it was just a tall tale, but he was making it into a parable that also related to her. Hmm. He was giving an example of his background, of what he did, maybe heavily embellished, but it matched Kira's struggles as a freedom fighter. That's how I saw that scene.
Well, you could certainly look at it that way, or you could look at it like he was just trying to find a way in with her, you know?
Yeah.
So if he started drawing a parallel between his fight to keep his house mm-hmm. and her freedom fighting past, that maybe he was going to get past her somehow. But it's so short-sighted and really naive to think that she's the last person. If he can convince her, then that's it. Then he's won. Because you know there's just another bureaucrat standing behind her.
Right. Yeah, I would agree with that. I would see his goal here was to try and tell a story that related to her.
Yeah. So he steps outside and Kira follows.
Yeah.
He points at a half-finished kiln, saying he's got to finish that project someday so he can start making some baking pots or something. I don't know what he's doing with that kiln. Kira says she sympathizes with him wanting to stay, but he has to leave. As soon as they start tapping the crust, the air will become unbreathable. He says the Cardassians probably told you you didn't stand a chance either. Did you surrender? He says, why do you expect me to act any differently from you? You tell them they can start cracking this moon apart whenever they're ready, and I'll be here. And she just says, I'll tell them.
Yeah, he does not want to go.
And this is why I was trying to say that to me, it feels like he's trying to manipulate her a little bit to get her to see it as if this were the same as her freedom fighting days, which it isn't, because he's only out for himself here. And she was fighting for a bigger cause. But he's trying to say, see, I'm just doing the same thing that you did.
Oh, I agree. Yes, I think that's very much what was going on here. If he was trying to make this situation relatable to her. And appeal to her sort of sense of justice, I think, that this was exactly the same situation. But I will add to that, she went and fought for her people. She didn't hide on a moon for 40 years when your people were suffering.
Yeah, but you don't know his story. They never really tell it. You don't know why he left.
Well, he said that he was in a Cardassian labor camp and he escaped.
Yeah. But they don't really explore, like, why he doesn't go back or any, you know, what happened to his family. Because they have that thing later where he's crying out in his sleep.
Yeah.
So you're supposed to believe there's some kind of trauma there, but we don't know what it is.
Yeah.
And to me, that's part of the story, mm-hmm. is that they're purposely not telling you that. Instead of trying to drag you down a real sentimental path of, you know, oh, this bad thing happened and this bad thing happened, they're making it a little bit more of a mystery so that it makes Kira's decision-making even more difficult.
Well, yes, it's good. They're making it more nuanced.
Right, yeah.
I gotta admit, I do kind of like that because I'm jumping backwards, but as I say, there was two ways I was looking at this.
Nog and Jake are surveying their new stack of self-sealing stem bolts, whatever those are.
We do get to see what a stem bolt is, though.
That's true. They do hold it up and you see the self-sealing things come out of it, whatever. Nog is saying this is high-quality merchandise and you can't get a better stem bolt in the sector. I'm not sure how he knows that or if he's just doing that thing where you sell the sizzle and not the steak that Quark was doing.
No, he's basically quoting exactly what the captain said earlier.
The captain said that?
Yes, the captain said all of that earlier.
Oh, okay, I forgot. Okay, that makes sense. That makes sense. The door opens and in walks Miles with his sleeves rolled up. He asks if they know what this cargo is doing here. In the cargo bay? Isn't that what the cargo bay is for? Nog says it belongs to his uncle Quark. Nog lies very easily. This is why he's not a good influence on Jake.
He's very Ferengi.
Yeah. Wait, fake news. That's what happened in the Negus. People think we lie. We don't lie. Miles says, tell your uncle that we're getting a little weary of him bypassing our import procedures. And Nog says he will. Then Miles wonders what Quark needs with all of these stem bolts. And Nog, having no idea, says, the usual.
Yeah.
And now Miles is suspicious for sure, but he leaves. He's like, whatever.
Miles is very suspicious of everything that's going on here.
Well, he should be, certainly when Nog is involved. What's really funny is that after he leaves, Nog was mad because he was really hoping that Miles would know what those bolts were for and would tell them, yes. But he didn't even know. He said he'd never seen them before.
The interaction here between Miles, Jake, and Nog is pretty funny.
Right. Oh, and I just realized, too, Jake is wearing his purple outfit again, by the way.
I was wondering if you would notice that one.
I did notice that. Nog says they can ask the Bajoran who ordered them in the first place. That guy must know what they're for. They scan the shipping labels and find the guy's name and address. And sweet Jake wonders if he'll be mad that they now have his stem bolts. But Nog says it doesn't matter because he couldn't afford them, and now they'll be able to offer them up to him at a discount. And he's quite gleeful about this.
Jake and Nog continue their plan for profit.
Yeah, running in circles.
This whole sub-story within the episode, I personally find quite funny because it reminds me of an old British TV show called Only Fools and Horses that was insanely popular for a long time, as it featured these two sort of ne'er-do-wells always trying to make the deal that'll get them rich.
Mm-mm. Yeah.
Which was the premise of that show.
Well, these two are like the comic relief sometime, yes, with their little shenanigans going on in the background.
Oh, yeah, very much so.
Now we're in ops, and Kira is coming up the very slow elevator. Dax tells Kira she was getting a little worried about her because it took her so long to get back. Kira just sighs and asks if Sisko is alone in his office, and Dax tells her that Minister Toran is in there, and she says even better. Then in Sisko's office, Toran is saying that there were 47 other people who left the moon willingly. Kira says, we only know they obeyed the order to leave. We don't know if they left willingly.
Oops, forced relocation. Yeah. Never good.
And Toran says this guy will too, but Kira's not so sure. Sisko wonders if there's something they can offer him to convince him to leave, and she says no. Sisko offers to postpone, but Toran says no. He suggests they just beam him off against his will. Wouldn't this be a thing that happened all the time with the beaming technology? I mean, if the guy won't leave, you just beam him off.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Toran says three stubborn holdouts aren't going to jeopardize this project. And Kira says we could tap the core using phased energy retrieval. And Toran says we agreed that method would take too long and we'd have to wait a full year to tap enough energy and we don't have that kind of time. So we'll just act like Cardassians, Kira says.
Boom.
That's a big stab. Easy, Major, Sisko says. That is quite an insult. Toran, of course, resents the implication.
I liked how Sisko saw where she was going or what was happening with Kira, because he was picking up that very clearly this is a huge problem for her. And the fact that she's going there to, we're now behaving like the Cardassians, is a problem. I liked how he stepped in to, you know, try and defuse the situation.
Yeah, I'm not 100% in favor of how he did it, but I think instead he should have done a look over here distraction rather than sort of cutting her down to size.
Yeah.
There's the leadership part of the podcast for me.
Uh-huh.
It's like, I appreciated that he stopped her from escalating too far, but I didn't necessarily appreciate that he had to cut her down to size.
Yeah.
This is kind of where the title of the episode comes into play, because the title of the episode is Progress. And we're supposed to see that this is a way forward. And this is not like going back to behaving how the Cardassians did. Instead, this is us trying to pull Bajor into the future.
Yeah.
I thought that was just kind of an interesting tie-in.
I mean, they also talked about how it would help hundreds of thousands of Bajorans. I assume there was some kind of energy crisis on Bajor, and that there was also a public health issue here of if they didn't have power, were these people going to freeze to death?
Yeah, they don't say that. They don't talk about how urgent it is or whether or not it's just a way to get cheaper power or something. You know, they don't talk about the whys behind it.
Uh-huh.
I think you have to assume that there is some kind of a crisis that this is supposed to help with.
I kind of like that, because they don't spoon feed you everything. And as you pointed out earlier, they're not being overly sentimental. In the same way here, they're not telling you exactly why. So they're leaving enough of it open for you for it to be very morally ambiguous. You could just literally go, well, if we don't get this power to 200,000 Bajoran homes, these people will freeze to death next winter and the death toll will be 13%.
Right.
And you go, oh, okay, well, this guy's just being a, you know,
the needs of the many.
Yeah, the needs of the many. This guy is being an obstacle. And the fact that they don't do that makes it a much more interesting.
It makes you think maybe they're just trying to get some cheap power.
Yeah, well, I mean, yeah, you could go either way. You could look at it as maybe they just want cheap power, or maybe it is, look, this is life or death for a large number of people.
Yeah.
I do like that in the writing here.
But I think we can remember from episode one where we talked about how the Cardassians had stripped all of their resources.
Yes.
And this is, you know, they're talking here about a way to sustain themselves. They don't need any outside resources to replace whatever the Cardassians took.
Right.
So instead, they're kind of stealing from themselves. But at this point, Toran looks Kira up and down, which I did not appreciate. And he says it's obvious that she's developed feelings for this man. And if she can't complete the assignment, he'll find someone who can. Right away, we have to go to the male-female thing. And of course, that's going to annoy me.
Interesting.
Anyway, Kira looks a little stung and she says that won't be necessary. One thing she needs to learn, I think, is which battles to fight and how to fight them. Things are so, everything is so important to her that, you know, she's got to find a way on that spectrum of zero to anger. She's got to find a way to know when to dial it up and when to hold it back. That's the political part of the job that she's still learning.
Well, I think that's because she's come from this fighting background, and her first reaction, as we've seen before, is to pull out the phaser and try shooting.
Yeah.
At least they're being very consistent to the character here.
True.
The character is slowly developing, but still goes back to that she has a fighter spirit.
And at least she's developing.
Right, yeah.
Kira then takes a shuttle and a couple of big Bajorans down to the moon.
Oh, yeah, they are big dudes.
Yeah, they are big dudes. She sends them off to find the non-speaking couple. She tells them to remember that they don't speak, and they were victims of the Cardassians. She says if they're not in their cottage, just gather up their clothes. And she says, we're not going to get their permission, but let's be careful.
That was a nice contrast there, because
you
had these two really big dudes, and those were big guys.
Yes.
And the way one of them says, with like real sort of surprise, he looked really surprised when he said, without permission?
Yep.
And I thought that was a nice, like I said, that was a nice contrast, because you had this guy who looked like a big thug and seemed genuinely concerned that they were going to be doing this without the consent of the settlers.
Nice people come in all sizes. Then Mullyback comes out and immediately notices that she's now got a phaser on her hip. She says it's just protocol. A really big phaser in a massive holster is what's on her hip. It looks so out of whack with her tiny frame. They couldn't give her a small phaser. It looks ridiculous.
I'm going to go with that was deliberate posturing.
Yeah, but she had to know that wasn't going to work on him. He goes back in his cottage and shuts the door on her, and she bangs on the door and says, please don't make us take you by force.
I think she was being hopeful here.
She thought he would just fall in line because now suddenly it's a military operation or something. He comes out with a bucket and starts filling it from the well as Kira pleads with him. He's really not interested in what she has to say, and he just goes about his business. He says she sounds like a two-headed Malgorian, whatever the heck that is. And then he rambles a bit about that, and Kira says he's going to have to stop telling stories eventually and deal with the situation. He just ignores her and goes on working on his kiln. Then the Bajoran security officers drag the silent couple in, saying, they're crazy. One of them stabbed one of the security guys and he's bleeding. But Mullyback goes a bit nuts when he sees this, and he starts beating on one of the security guys, throwing him to the ground. This is not going the way Kira wanted.
No.
They should have just beamed them out at this point. But in the scuffle, the other security officer points his phaser at Brian Keith and fires as Kira shouts, no, and he drops to the ground. We should have known better than to turn up with phasers. It was a terrible idea.
Well,
this is not a good plan. We make such terrible plans on the show. We should sit down and talk about it. Don't just go in with the phasers. Oh, my God. Anyway, she tells the guy who fired to go and get Dr. Bashir immediately.
My observation here is, now, why couldn't Mullibok have fought the Cardassians like that instead of hiding out on the moon?
Well, but he does say that he fought off like six of them or whatever.
Yeah, right? For his own benefit, too.
Okay, I get it. And we go back to DS9, and Nog and Jake are trying to communicate with the guy who originally ordered the bolts. Nog is using a screwdriver on the comm device, and there are sparks, and it's all staticky.
It's probably a sonic screwdriver.
From Doctor Who?
Could be.
But regardless of what tool he's using, he's obviously trying to conceal the video by making it look like there's interference on the line. The guy is asking who he is, and Nog says it's the No J Consortium. He tells the guy they have the stem bolts, and they try to sell them to the guy for 5, then 4, then 3 bars of platinum. But the guy says if he had that kind of money, he'd already have the bolts. So he offers another exchange. The guy says he can offer them a piece of land. But Nog says land is no good because it's nothing but dirt, which I'm pretty sure is an argument I've made in the past when we've gone to see the remnants of an ancient fort.
Yes.
And it just turned out to be empty land. And I believe I said something just like what Nog said.
Yeah, this is exactly how I would expect you to react. That is something you would say. It's dirt. It's land. It's dirt.
But, you know, not when it's about ownership, just when it's about me going to visit something. It's totally different.
Yeah.
I can see the value of owning land.
I admit I'm surprised that Nog isn't getting the concept of trading. I thought that would be very Ferengi. Jake seems to be pushing him at this point to, you know, make these trades, and you can trade A for B and so on.
Well, because Jake doesn't have an end goal, and Nog has this end goal in his mind. The only win is Latinum, whereas Jake's like, I don't know, let's get land.
that's true. But I guess maybe that's one of the limitations of Ferengi.
Maybe. Single-minded.
The really good Ferengi, maybe like the Negus, are thinking in the big picture, and most of the other Ferengi are very short-term goal. I want the Latinum now. but if you trade it for this and then this and this, right, then you end up with twice the Ladin.
Well, if Nog is smart, he's learning from this whole thing. And in the end, he will, well, I guess we'll see what happens when he gets to the end, but hopefully he's learning from Jake and then learning from this whole experience and making himself smarter and not just sticking to the I need Latinum, you know, script.
Yeah. Well, what's actually funny is, and no spoilers, but there's an episode in the future in several seasons' time, which follows a very similar path to this.
Okay. I assume Jake is a lot taller.
Yeah, yes.
So the guy on the phone, I don't know, I call it the phone. That's not right.
it's close enough to a phone. You know.
I don't know what to call
it. It's like a modern cell phone.
Communicator. He says he can offer them 7 tessipates, which is another lovely made-up Star Trek word. Jake says, 7 sounds good. I think that's my favorite line of this whole episode.
Oh, yeah.
It's more than 5. We're trying to get 5 bars of Latinum. Now we have 7 tessipates of something. They have no idea what this is.
Nope, so they have no idea what they're doing, but they seem to be enjoying it.
They carry on. Nog doesn't want to do any more exchanges. He just wants the Latinum. And I'm not sure he's destined to ever get the Latinum at this point. He's only interested in profit. And I think Jake just thinks it's a fun game.
Yeah.
Jake asks very wisely for some proof that he owns the land. And I thought, too, maybe you guys ought to check to see where the land is. What if it's at the bottom of a volcano or something? It's some swamp land in Florida.
What if it's Glengarry Glen Ross?
Right, look into it. They don't. The guy says he'll transmit them some info, so it's like, okay, at least they'll find out if they really can obtain the land.
Yeah, Jake is very much the smart one in this situation.
Yeah, because Nog is not happy. Yeah. He does not want dirt, but yeah. Okay, back down on the moon, Dr. Bashir is there now, and he's tending to Mullyback, and he says, the phaser blast punctured your peritoneum, which Google says is the membrane lining of the abdomen.
Oh.
He tells him to rest easy, because if you move around, you're going to make it worse. That does sound painful. Mullyback isn't thrilled to see another uniform. Kira is standing in the background looking sullen, and Bashir tells him that Kira sent for him, and Mullyback says, you're backwards, Nerys. And Kira runs out. Then he wonders why, when he was unconscious, she didn't just get them off the moon. And I thought the same exact thing. Why didn't she just beam them off?
Yeah, that would be a perfect excuse. Have to take him to Deep Space Nine to recover.
Julian tells him that his 2 silent friends have been evacuated. Then he says he's going to take him back to the station. But Mullyback is like, nope, that is not happening.
Forcibly relocated.
Yeah. Bashir leaves him and goes outside to talk to Kira. He says he's going to take Mullyback to the station with or without his permission. And Kira says, no, you're not. She says she's going to stay and look after him. Just leave the medical instructions. Then she takes off her jacket, which I felt was symbolic.
Very much
so. And she starts working on the kiln.
Yeah.
She is feeling very guilty. And she definitely wavers dramatically in her convictions. It's like she wants to follow orders and toe the line. But it just so often works against this deep moral code that she has. Yeah. And every time she's pressed, she falls back to her own code.
And I think that taking off the jacket was very much an indication of her rejecting the bureaucratic Bajoran authority that she's been forced to carry out the orders.
Wow, as usual, we see things differently. I didn't view it that way. I viewed it more as her just saying, you know, I'm going to set this symbol of what I'm representing. I'm just going to set that aside for now, and I'm just going to stand here for myself. That was the way I saw it.
Oh, that's a good way. I don't think our takes are too off there. I think we're both on the same sort of path.
Yeah, they're similar.
The third option is that she was just building a kiln and it would get kind of hot.
Well, there is that. And it was out in the sun.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's a much more boring one. I'd skip that one.
It could be that, though. Then we go back to Deep Space Nine, and Julian is now telling Sisko what happened, saying that she didn't offer any explanation. She simply removed her uniform tunic and started working on the kiln.
I'm going to point out that this is a 9.5 frowny face Sisko. If we have a Sisko frowny scale...
He's not happy.
No, I'm going to go revise that. This is a 9.9 frowny face Sisko.
He says that he's worried she's going to lose her right to wear the uniform anyway, which I imagine is something that Kira has already thought of. He says he's going to tell Minister Toran that she's remained temporarily on the moon at Bashir's request. But sir, that isn't true, Bashir says. He's so naive. He's just like, get the clues. Then Sisko turns and looks at Bashir and says, make it true, doctor. Now, please.
That is my line of the episode. I thought that was great. Make it true, doctor. I just love how Avery portrays this character. I mean, I know I'm a fanboy, but we see his sort of flexibility here and the way he, again, is standing up for his people. He's doing something to directly protect Kira as much from herself as anything else.
Right. I mean, that's clearly his plan.
This reflects his ability to take an unconventional path. He's going to do something that if you were a Starfleet rule follower, you wouldn't do. And the way it surprises the doctor as well.
But if you're a leader, this is exactly what you're going to do.
Yeah.
You're looking out for your people. You're trying to make sure they're on the right path. And he's not going to force her path. That's not the plan, right? It is, he's going to go down, make sure she's seeing logic, although we're jumping ahead now. We shouldn't be talking about this here. We're interrupting the whole flow of this scene. The whole thing is going to happen later.
But this is another scene I enjoy because we're starting to see what made this show great.
Okay, that's good. So Bashir finally gets the clue and he sort of swallows and he says, "Commander, I recommend that Major Kira remain on Jurado for humanitarian reasons." Then he whispers, "Oh, for how long?" And Sisko says, "For the next day or two." So then he's like, "For the next day or two." And Sisko says, "Thank you, doctor." And he says, "I'll consider that request." And then he dismisses him.
Yeah.
I really like this scene. And it's good leadership because we're going to see some more of it later. But in this particular scene, it was kind of good because he led Julian down a path to show him, hey, this is the way we're going to do it.
Yeah.
I want you to see it my way. It's like, I'm not going to go off and tell a lie. Exactly. So just tell me this thing. And I don't know. I thought that was pretty good leadership.
Yes. And I think it shows Sisko's ability that he knows how to play Starfleet, as it were. Starfleet's an organization of rules, regulations, and ways to do things. And I thought what we saw was Sisko doing just that. Well, the doctor's orders could override the mission parameters. Doctor, you're going to override those parameters, aren't you? Yes. And that, I think, shows Sisko's flexibility.
Right. Okay. Now we go back down to the moon again, and Kira is using a medical device on Mullyback for deep bruising. That sounds like a handy device. He asks what they'll do to her for staying with him, and she says, probably the same thing they're going to do to you. Then she steps away from him, dropping the device on the table, and Mullyback says, what are you so angry about? Which, by the way, we've seen her angry. This is not Kira angry, but she says she doesn't really know. She sighs, and she tells a story of when she was small and had this ugly tree outside of her window. It was so ugly, even the birds stayed away from it. And Mullyback says, oh, but you loved it. Hated it, Kira says. It had grown so huge, its branches blocked the sun for kelipates, another made-up word. And the roots were so deep, nothing else could grow there. It was a big, selfish, annoying, nasty old tree. And I sense the episode's lesson is approaching.
Okay, I'm going to just state that, so another allegorical story. Doesn't this make the third allegory in just one show?
She's recognizing that's the way he communicates, whether it's on purpose or by accident. And so she's flipping it around on him.
Yes.
And I think when he added the word nasty, he was seeing that it was an allegory.
Yeah, that was a very smart move by her. I mean, he did that piece at the beginning of putting his story to appeal to her in a way that she might understand. And then she's telling a story in reverse to make him understand. I mean, nice touch.
I like this next part because Brian Keith says, it sounds like the tree has a lot of character. And she gives a little smile and he asks if she cut the tree down. And she says, I don't know yet. That was a really important part of the story.
Yes.
Just as Sisko calls for a chat, he says he's coming down. And Mullyback very quietly says, he doesn't have much faith in you, does he? Which is a bit of a dig and completely not right.
Yeah.
He has a lot of faith in Kira, and that's why he's coming down.
That's why he's going there, right.
So Sisko beams into the courtyard and looks around at the idyllic landscape. And then he knocks on the door, and Brian Keith answers saying, nobody wants him there, but he's such a curmudgeon. But Kira comes up behind and says, don't speak for me.
I liked how Sisko said, you're causing a lot of trouble.
Yeah, and that seems to really tickle him.
And Brian Keith's reply, I can't tell you how much I'm delighted to hear that.
Yeah, he was very happy to be the cause of some trouble.
He really is grumpy.
Brian Keith then, or Mullyback, Brian Keith is a much better name, asks, it's like Kaiopaka Naomi Osaka, except this is this guy's real name. Brian Keith asks how many officers he's going to send to get him, and Sisko says he's there because he's concerned about his first officer, not about Mullyback. He says she's jeopardizing her career by staying there. Kira tells Brian Keith to go lie down and let them talk, and Mullyback says, why don't you tell him the story about your tree, which was hilarious.
Yes.
Kira tells him to be quiet and go inside. And there's some really, I don't know if you noticed this, but there was some very serious close talking in this scene. He was like 2 inches from her face. I would never speak to a person that closely. It's too close.
I think the casting here was great.
Oh, it's awesome.
I mean, they did such a good job. And he delivers this character so well.
Really, really well.
And carries it well.
He seemed to understand it. And it's hard to know if it's because they kind of wrote it for him. And so it was fitting of him. Or if he just really sort of grokked onto it and was playing it so well. Who knows? Either way, it worked well.
I would expect with an actor of his caliber and experience that this was something he could really sink his teeth into and work with.
168 IMDb credits. Yeah, he knew what he was doing.
Yeah, I think so.
Probably wasn't 168 by then, but it was a lot.
I keep thinking of the movie Up at this point, or as we like to call it, Up,
a downer. I hate that movie. That movie is so depressing.
Yes.
I can see why you might say that. I don't think there are too many parallels other than the little old guy getting kicked out of his house. This would have made a better version of Up. But anyway, before he goes inside, Mollybeck starts to tell the story about the big ugly tree. And then he stops and he like waves his hand like, nah, never mind. And he goes inside. It was hilarious.
Yes.
Sisko sees why Kira thinks the quirky guy is likable.
Yeah.
He tells her that he'd like her to come back to work because he doesn't really want to have to break in a new liaison officer. He says she's not doing her job, which she well knows, but she's not able to let go of this situation. He kind of folds his hands up in front of his face like he's saying a prayer, and he says he understands that she's used to sympathizing with the underdog, which kind of makes her laugh. He's like, you spent your life fighting to overcome impossible odds, just like what Mollybeck is doing. But you need to realize that you're on the other side now, which stings her. She looks like she's going to break down at that point. And he says, when he first met her, he thought she was hostile and arrogant, which seems right. But he says he was wrong, and Bajor needs her, and he needs her. And then he says, I like you, and I don't want you to be hurt. He also told Odo he liked him once. It's just like an odd turn of phrase, but it seems to work for him. I don't remember Picard ever telling a crew member that he liked them.
That's because he didn't really like any of them.
He didn't like anybody, except Data. Anyway, he then stands up and says, as a friend, I'm here to remind you that his fate is already decided and yours isn't. She says thank you, and then he beams away.
Oh, this scene.
It was a tough scene. I mean, ultimately, though, she's got to realize that what she's doing is for the betterment of her overall cause, which is to help Bajor as a people, not just one or two individuals or even for herself.
Well, and on top of that, her role as the liaison on the station to the Federation, that's also a critical role for Bajor.
Right.
I find this scene just fascinating. I mean, Sisko starts off, again, being very formal, and he delivers some great lines in here.
Yeah.
And then again, he transitions from formal to friend. I love this scene.
Yeah, this is a good scene. I wish they'd given Kira a few lines in it rather than just her sort of, you know, being tearful and having someone else speak for her.
But she kept her emotion under control, and I think that was very important for this character.
She was quivering. It was coming. Yeah.
But she never crossed that edge.
Yep.
This was upsetting to her because
it was beautiful acting by her. It was just fantastic face acting.
In my notes, I put Sisko spells out the horrible truth, which is you are the other side now.
Yeah, and it's really hard for her to accept that it's okay to be the other side.
Yeah.
Because she really wants to sort of protect that little guy because she felt like the little guy for so long.
Yes.
So it's really tough for her to find that thing that's important now, you know, and how it's different from what it used to be for her before. Yeah, you can really see the struggle.
Yes. Sisko as well, demonstrating his abilities of how he knows people. I mean, look what he did here. I mean, and his line where he said to her, his fate is already decided, yours isn't.
No, that's a great line.
His ability to appeal to her in a way that she'll understand is another strength of this character. I've said it before. I'm going to say it again. This is another glimpse of why I love this show. Even this early on, it's not just good. It's great.
Okay. I could say more, but I feel like we're beating a dead horse. Now it's later that night, and Mollybeck is groaning in his sleep. Kira is sleeping, kind of, in what looks like a rock-hard rocking chair. There's no way she's sleeping like that.
I've had friends who could sit upright in a chair. So
in a hard chair?
In a hard chair.
Oh my gosh.
Sleep upright.
I would be crippled. She wakes up and hears him groaning, and she goes to get a hypo spray for him as he's mumbling, you're hurting her. And he says the name Lucilla, which I didn't really make out in his mumbles, but it was in the closed captions. And I don't know if we're supposed to think that maybe that was a long dead wife. I don't know. We never cover it.
Ah, I'm guessing that's an advantage to closed captioning because I did not hear the name.
Ah. Kira puts a wet cloth on his forehead and says, everything is going to be fine. He wakes up finally and says, oh, it's you. which was funny. And she tells him to go back to sleep as he kind of grumbles. He tells her to bring her chair closer, which she does. She's just A-plus acting in this episode. I mean, she's so good. I'm incredibly impressed.
Yes. Now you know why I love that character, too. Yeah.
Now we go back to the station, and Nog and Jake are playing cards again, and Nog is distracted. He says he's thinking about Latinum and how they don't have any. They just have dirt.
We have dirt, not Latinum.
So great. Jake says, it's not dirt, it's land, and we should sell it. How do teenagers sell land? Then they get into an argument about whether bolts are better than land. I mean, oh my God, they're such teenagers.
It's oh, it's so great.
Coming down the stairs at this point are Odo and Quark, and they're discussing the No J Consortium. And the kids are suddenly interested in what they're talking about. Quark has never heard of this group, and Odo says the Bajoran government want to build a reclamation facility on a strip of land owned by four different people. Three of them have agreed to sell, but they don't know how to find this consortium. Quark says, what a wonderful opportunity for profit. And you can yes. see like little light bulbs going off over Nog's head as they listen in.
And also Quark, a look of professional jealousy on his face there of, oh, wait, somebody's got something up and I'm not involved.
Right. Who is this consortium? Yeah. So the kids are pretty excited, and Quark says he doesn't know who they are, but he's going to open negotiations with them shortly, even though he doesn't know who they are.
I admire his confidence.
Yeah. Odo scoffs, his usual reaction, and he leaves as Quark yeah. goes for his secret stash of security spark plugs.
3854, Morn is at the bar.
I did notice that. Thank you. Nog tries to talk to Quark, but he keeps brushing him off, telling him to go sweep the floor. But finally, Nog says he has a business opportunity that will only cost him 5 bars of Latinum. They should really look into the value of this land before giving it to Quark for 5 bars, but he's so stuck on this number.
Yeah.
Quark finally figures out that Nog and Jake have the land, and he shakes his head in disbelief.
It's the way he turns around and looks at the two of them, and you can see the cogs turning. That was also a classic sort of piece of television, the way they did that.
Yeah.
So another comment here, I mean, if Nog had been a better business person, shouldn't he have offered his uncle a percentage deal? Sell the land and we'll split it 50-50.
Maybe, except I think, like I said, he has a single goal, is he wants 5 bars of Latinum, and he finally sees the way to get to the goal.
In the next episode, we see Quark packing up to leave because he just sold the land sold for 3.5 million bars.
Oh, yeah, geez. Yeah. Yeah, no, Nog is very much in a do not pass go state of mind. He's like, I'm just going for my one thing and I got it.
Yep.
So now Kira wakes up in her rocking chair, which I still say she wasn't sleeping in. Anyway, she finds Molly back is outside working on his kiln. She hands him the last stone for the kiln, and then they stand there and admire it. She goes inside as he lights it up. Then when she comes out, she's got a packed bag, and she says she could really use a friend on Bajor, and she'd like it to be him. He says as long as the cottage is still standing, he's staying there. And so I immediately typed in, so knock it down. Why is it still standing? Well, she does one better. She uses her phaser to blow the top off the kiln, and then she takes the fire from the kiln and lights the cottage roof on fire, and she burns the place down.
Oh, yeah.
Make it happen, Kira. Yeah.
Scorched earth. No messing around.
He just stands there. She does it. He doesn't fight with her or say anything.
I thought that was very symbolic.
Yes,
I think
it was.
He reached the point where he knew he wasn't going to win here. This was the end of it. He tried everything he could with Kira, and she was the unmovable object.
I hope that he also realized that what he was doing was actually damaging her.
That's another good take. I didn't think of that.
Yeah.
I didn't think of that because he was such a self-focused character, as I
know,
saw.
And I always hope for the best for people. So I just hope that he could see that she was willing to give up so much for him, but yeah. It was pointless.
And I think that maybe that was part of demonstrating the difference between those two characters. Kira yeah. has basically given up her life for Bajor, for the Bajoran people, for their yep. liberation. And now she's serving as the liaison at Deep Space Nine. So Kira's whole life is about service.
Yes.
And his isn't. He's been hiding on a moon for the last 40 years and hasn't gotten involved and hasn't done the things that he could do. So I looked at him as very selfish, and Kira is the opposite.
I know you did, and I really didn't see it that way. I always look at people as dealing with damage in whatever way they're able to is okay. And I don't know what his damage is. And we weren't meant to know. They didn't tell us. Yes, yeah. They gave us a sort of skeleton of a story. But at the same time, you know, he was embellishing all of his stories. So you don't really know what the true thing was. I look at it like he's got some damage I don't understand. And that's kind of how I thought Kira was looking at it. She understood, the overarching structure of what had happened to him.
Yes.
But she didn't need to hear any of the grisly details because whatever it was, she knew there was damage and she wanted to protect him and help him. So I don't view it as selfish.
I look at this as a well-written show in the way that you can look at both sides of this and go either way. You could take more cynical view or you could take a more positive view in the interpretation of what's happened. I can't fault the writers for doing that. You don't know enough about the story, his story, or the story of the Bajorans requiring power. You can take it either way. I'm impressed with that it has that level of subtlety.
Yeah, I really like stories like that, that let you sort of, you know, I guess, interpret the human condition in the way that works for you.
The Bajoran condition.
It's not super easy to write, but it's really easy to consume.
I think. And it's great when it works.
You misinterpret what I say by saying the Bajoran condition, because that's not real. And I don't care about that in the slightest. I always view it as, how does this illuminate the human condition? That's what interests me in stories.
Yeah, that's great about the human condition. That's so good.
He's still a little old curmudgeon, you know?
Yeah.
And he says to her, you chose your uniform over me after all. And I really wanted her to stand up for herself because that is emotional blackmail.
Yeah.
But she just says, it's over. It's time we get on with our lives, both of us.
Well, I think that's because she's reached a point where that didn't work.
He says, prove you're my friend by using the weapon on me. He turns her back on her and she just says, two to beam up, and the show ends.
Wow.
Which was a great ending. So dramatic.
Yes.
It was so important to the development of Kira and to this story that he never relented.
Right. He didn't.
Nope.
Well, in some ways, it was a parallel to her.
Meaning?
She's unrelenting. She's the immovable object. That's why I think he didn't try to stop her from burning the place down. Because
yes.
He'd run into an object as immovable as he was. And she wasn't going to back down.
Yeah, I hadn't thought about that they were both unchanging. She almost did, but then she kind of wised up and realized again that, you know, the needs of the many Bajorans are going to outweigh the needs of the few.
Well, I think that showed her strength as well.
Yes.
She was somebody who was, not only she's strong, but she's able to flex, to see his point of view and to have sympathy with him and able to come back and be the strong character.
And she was trying hard to get him to see that it was best for him to leave.
Yeah.
And he was just never going to. And finally she realized that it was an unwinnable battle.
Right.
And she didn't want to go down with that ship. But I wonder if she saw him as a potential future for her, that, you know, she could have turned into the same thing, which was sort of abandon the cause and just go off and live somewhere and then have somebody turn up and tell her, hey, you got to get off of here, and how she would have reacted. You know, I wonder if in those closing scenes, she was seeing how she could have ended up here too. And now she was just like, I am not going to end up here. We are moving on.
You've hit the nail on the head there. I think that's definitely how she could have, it could have been her.
Yeah, absolutely.
Is the take there. Yeah.
Okay, well, end of the episode, which we were just doing a bunch of analysis there, but what else have you got for over-analysis?
Well, first of all, I am very concerned that the Federation were helping the Bajorans destroy a working ecosystem. If you notice, when Sisko beamed onto the planet, there was greenery, there were birds chirping. There was an active ecosystem there, and Kira talked about how sulfur and other contaminants would be released into the atmosphere.
Yeah.
And the Federation are helping them destroy an active ecosystem when there was an alternative that would just take a little bit longer, but they wanted to rush this through.
Gosh, that is true.
That does not sound like good Federation policy there.
Scorched earth.
Yeah, I found that kind of disturbing of what they were prepared to do there.
But at the same point, one of the goals, if you remember from the first episode, was finding ways for Bajor to look after themselves, to be self-sustaining.
Yes.
And if this was helping them on that path, that might be why the Federation thought it was okay.
There are other things, like this could be a tiny habitable pocket on the planet, and the rest of it is pretty unlivable.
And maybe they'd already moved off all of the animals and everything, and they just had some bird noises piped in.
It was just environmental noise. They had some outdoor speakers. And another counter to this, it could be the Bajorans are in a desperate state, and it is, we have this power, or thousands of people freeze to death during the winter. I mean, make a choice.
Yeah, imagine if they had shown that side of the story, how differently you would have looked at this guy.
Yes. That's why this story, I think, works well. If they didn't show you those things, they just hinted at them.
Yeah.
So you could take it either way of they just want cheap power, or it's, no, they really need this.
They chose to keep the story small, which I like. You got 46 minutes. And if what's important to you is developing Kira, then good choice.
Yeah, very well done. So the other overanalysis on this is, and this is playing very much the devil's advocate, was Sisko just being self-serving in convincing Kira to carry out his duties? Her presence benefits him on the station. And as he said, she's already been trained in dealing with the Federation and he can work with her. Was this purely a manipulative Sisko appealing to her because it benefited him and Starfleet?
Well, ultimately, that's what all leadership is about.
Oh.
Don't quote me on that.
And I'm supposed to be the cynical one. I jest.
I mean, it is about how do you move the whole thing forward.
Yeah.
It's entirely possible that he's looking at it like, if she's changed out, it's going to slow down the whole thing and I'm going to have to retrain a new person and blah, blah, blah. But honestly, I don't think we've seen any evidence that his reasoning is that selfish. Yeah.
I didn't see that. I was just purely being the devil's advocate.
Part of my overanalysis is that it was just so important that Kira had to make a tough decision at the end.
Yes.
He never said, okay, fine, or you win, or whatever. He turned his back on her, and she just said, two to beam up. And I thought that was really critical for character development.
Yeah. Leadership comes with a price.
Yeah. Sometimes, certainly, making the right decision just doesn't feel right.
If you look at the decision in the macro level, there's no question. But when you start dealing with the individual, all of a sudden, it becomes very personal and very hard.
Well, if we talk about the leadership part of the podcast, we certainly saw a lot of leadership from Sisko in this episode. I mean, this was a Kira episode, which was great. Very happy to have one. And I thought that his leadership was good. I thought it was really good when he was talking to Bashir and move him in the right direction.
Yeah.
I thought it was good when he was on the ground talking to Kira, but I didn't think it was great.
Really?
I felt like he did all of the talking. She barely had any lines in that scene. And I think it would have been nice to maybe have them have a conversation.
Yeah.
Is that it for your overanalysis?
That wraps it up.
All right, let's go to Women in the Future. This was a much better version of Kira than we've seen through the entire show. She wasn't just annoyed and angry all the time. I think it changed a bit after the episode where she was with the Kai.
Yes.
She allowed herself to release some of that anger and some of that volatility a little bit. She showed true empathy, and in the end, she realized what her duty was, and she did the right thing for Bajor, which is what she always says she wants to do. I thought that she could see herself in Mollyback, and she saw her past in his face. And ultimately, she realized that she was the only one who could see the future and that he was never going to see it. And so she had to make the tough choice for him. And I really liked that. I thought that was excellent.
Great.
Then there was the nonsense with Dax and Morn. And just, whatever. They could have just cut that out. That was dumb. But I think that's it for Women in the Future.
Ah.
Let's go to rating. Thumbs up, thumbs down, or neutral? What is your rating?
There can only be one rating for this one. Absolute thumbs up. This episode worked on so many levels, and you really do see the flashes of greatness that made this such a good series.
It's so interesting to me that the rating on IMDb for this episode was kind of low. It was under 7. It's hard for me to understand the ratings because I don't have the whole, you know, 7 seasons of the show in my mind to rate it with. So all I have are the 14 episodes. And in terms of how this rates within the 14 episodes, this is an easy thumbs up. I don't know what it's going to mean when I get 3 or 4 seasons in. Am I going to look back on this and look down on it? I don't know. But for now, this was great. I mean, I'm becoming a fan of Kira. It's happening because she's not just angry Kira all the time. They're turning her into something else, and I appreciate that.
One of the things about this episode is this is more like a flash forward to a later season in terms of the quality of the episode.
Okay, that's good, because I'd like more like this, please. Nog was still a little too manic for me. That little story with the two of them was adorable. Jake made all the right moves, but Nog followed right behind him. And hopefully he's learning from Jake, and Jake is not learning too much from him. That's all I can really hope. But yeah, overall, thumbs up.
Fantastic. I think this episode was also helped by the Jake and Nog story, it might have been a little too grim without that. So the Jake and Nog simultaneous story kind of added a little lift to it, a little levity to what is basically a harsh story about forced relocations.
Yeah, that's a really good point. Okay, I think that is it for season one, episode 14. I can't believe we've already done 14 of these. Crazy. Come back next week for episode 15. In the meantime, if you'd like to tell us your own overanalysis of this or any episode, or if you just want to say something nice, please email us at rebingeit@gmail.com or tweet us at rebingeit. Also, check us out on talkthroughmedia.com. You can leave feedback for us there and listen to all of our other awesome podcasts.
Thanks for joining us on the Rebinge Deep Space Nine podcast.
That's it for me.
And that's it for me.